Edison is credited with inventing the light bulb. A lot of controversy about that. Alexander Graham Bell, the telephone, controversy there too. But who invented the computer or deserved to be called the father of the internet? My next guest says those questions are tough to answer because more than most technological revolutions, the digital revolution was a team effort, not the lone inventor toiling away in a basement or the individual genius with a eureka moment. According to Walter Isaacson, it took hundreds of hackers, geniuses, and geeks to create our digital world, and he tells many of their stories in his new book, The Innovators. He's president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. You'll also recall he's author of the best-selling Steve Jobs. Good to see you again, Walter.
It's good to be back, Ira.
I remember when I interviewed you about Steve Jobs, you were working on this book about the same time.
Right. I had been working on it off and on. As you know, we were both Heathkit builders when we were growing up. We made ham radios and receivers and stuff. And so I always liked being an electronics kid. And I kind of wondered, how did all of this come to pass? So when I was at Time magazine, I was gathering string. You're lucky when you're a journalist, as you know. You get to meet people like Gordon Moore, Steve Jobs, or Bill Gates. And so over the course of the 90s, I would interview people about the computer, the internet, how it came to be, and finally the book gelled.
So sort of percolating in you all these
Well, you know, I was mainly doing the internet because I was working at Time Incorporated as the head of digital media, and my boss said, well, who owns the internet? And I'm thinking, that's a clueless question. And then he says, well, you know, who built it? And leaving aside the Al Gore jokes, I realized I didn't actually know. And you don't want to be too alienated from the history of the technology you use. As your previous guest said, that's what sets us apart from Neanderthals. We make our tools.
So what is different about the digital revolution that makes it a team effort versus, you know, the Edison, that sort of stuff? We sat in there toiling away at midnight.
I think partly you have a lot of really interesting visionaries. I mean, these are pretty exciting people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. Also people you probably haven't, many people probably haven't heard of, like J.C.R. Licklider and great people. But you have to be able to execute. You know, vision without execution is hallucination. And the people who had the vision of the early computers, like John Adanasoff in Iowa State, and they didn't have a team around them, those computers just gather dust in the basement. They get dismantled and thrown away. The digital age has, as part of its genetic coding, I think, peer-to-peer sharing, the way the internet is run, the way computers are done. They're for collaborative projects. And so I think there was a lot more collaboration between visionaries and engineers and executors, whether it was creating the microchip and the transistor or the internet and the computer.
Our number, 844-724-8255, if you want to talk with us, talk with Walter Isaacson. What did happen to John Adanasoff?
Well, you know, John Benson Adanasoff is that great lone inventor that you say we like to mythologize, like an Edison or Morse or a Bell. And he has the idea of an electronic circuit that can do logic. And he kind of gets it working, but he can't get the punch card burners working. He doesn't have engineers. He's got one graduate student working there. And finally, he goes into the Navy, and this thing has been built in the basement of a building in Iowa State, and they need the room, so they just throw it away. The only thing that saves them from history is the opposite sort of a guy named John Mauchly, who traveled all over the place, picking up ideas, listening to radio shows like this, going to scientific meetings. He was like a bumblebee cross-pollinating with ideas, and he picks up an idea, you know, drives out to Iowa to see this machine. He goes up to Bell Labs. He goes to Harvard, where they're doing the Mark I. And then he creates a team with Presper Eckert, an engineer, and six great women programmers, and they actually execute on making a machine, and that becomes ENIAC. So if you ask me what's the first programmable, general-purpose electronic computer, I'd say ENIAC, because to me, it's got to work before it counts.
And if you look at the computing power of an ENIAC compared to today, right?
I love it. It takes up an entire room, and I have in my pocket two devices that have more computing power.
It's quite interesting. You also recount a point in the history of Steve Jobs, and both in this book and in Steve Jobs' book, where he has a great quote that you quote him as saying, "Great people steal."
He attributes it to Picasso. I'm not sure Picasso ever said it, but we love quotes to float around on those quote sites. And it's good artists borrow, great artists steal. And it shows that there's collaboration between generations, too. I mean, mm-hmm. if you can take what I mentioned, Licklider, who creates interactive, easy-to-use graphical displays for the air defense system, you see that developed by people like Doug Engelbart with his mother of all demos, and then at Xerox PARC by Alan Kay. And one day, Steve Jobs pops up at Xerox PARC, and he says, man, you know, these bitmap screens with graphical user interfaces, incredibly cool, and he adopts it for the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. So the problem with the collaboration of the digital age is everybody collaborates, and then they sue each other by who had the idea first.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Walter Isaacson, author of The Innovation, The Invent Innovators. I'll get it right, Mike. Excuse me for my voice. It's the end of a cold this week. Everybody's sick here in New York. We were talking about how collaboration is very necessary these days. Did any of these collaborators, these people in the early computer era, could they actually foresee where we would be today?
Oh, I think there are some unbelievable visionaries. There's a guy named Vannevar Bush, who you certainly have heard of. He was a MIT dean, and then he runs wartime research during World War II.
He was Eisenhower's science
advisor. And before that, exactly. During World War II for Roosevelt and Truman, oversees the Manhattan Project. But he does two amazing essays in 1945. One talks about the collaboration of government, universities, and corporations to create new things, and that's what happens. And the other is called As We May Think, and it's about having a personal machine that remembers all your contact information and all your letters and emails, and you can retrieve it and you can search it. And it's like Wikipedia, Google, and the PC and your iPhone all rolled into one in 1945. And here's why it's so important. He envisioned that our technology would get more and more personal and more intimate and more connected with us, as opposed to the people who are pursuing artificial intelligence and machine learning and robots mm-hmm. that would deal mm-hmm. without us. And his vision turns out to be the one that we pursue, which is nowadays we put our computers on our wrists and in our pockets, and they're very personally connected to us.
Oh, so let's also talk about the days where we didn't have digital electronics, but we had binary computers back in the old days.
Yeah, well, binary was, you know, as you know, a form of digital. You have, you know, decimal and binary, whatever. But the point of it was to have on-off switches. I mean, you and I, once again, we were talking about building these things when we were kids. One of the things you learn when you build a circuit is that a transistor is basically an on-off switch, a gate. And you have logic gates that do things like, say, either or if and yes, no, off, on. And you put those together, and you get people like Claude Shannon and information theorists who can do Boolean algebra and say, oh, I can do logic with just a circuit of on-off switches. And then you get people inventing, you know, binary computers and digital computers that do use the on-off switches and those circuits to do anything. I mean, Ada Lovelace is one of the early heroes in the book because she says, once you're able to do that, it won't just do numbers. It'll do anything you can notate symbolically, art, music, words. And so they come up with the notion of the general purpose computer.
Do you think all these visionaries had that artistic side of them?
They don't all have it. We've been plagued in the digital revolution by a lot of engineers who didn't connect to the humanities, mm-hmm. who didn't have a sense of arts. The heroes of my book are the heroes in the mold of Steve Jobs, who told me very early on when I was starting writing his book, he said, you know, I like to stand at the intersection of the arts and technology. Right. And every time he did a product launch, he'd have street signs that said that. And so Ada Lovelace, whose father was Lord Byron, a poet, but she becomes a great mathematician, she says you've got to connect the poetry and the humanities to the engineering and the sciences, because that will make the intimate connection between us and our machinery. And her father, Lord Byron, was a Luddite, and I mean that literally, because he defends the followers of Ned Ludd and who are smashing the mechanical looms. But Ada says, no, those punch cards will be able to tell all of our machines how to do whatever we want, and we will supply the imagination. So that notion of, and you see it all the way, Steve Jobs, Alan Kay, all the way to the guys at Google, the people who can connect and believe that beauty matters, they connect mm-hmm. the arts and the sciences, they win.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. Just as it's hard to say who invented the Internet, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly when the Internet was born. But you could argue that it was 45 years ago, next week, October 29th. That's when a UCLA student named Charlie Klein sent the first message over a computer network. It wasn't the Internet quite yet. It was a network called ARPANET. And we've got Charlie on the line to talk about what happened. Charlie, welcome to Science Friday.
Welcome, Ira.
Do you remember that moment? I'm sure you do.
I remember it very well. A couple of weeks ago, you mentioned that this was the 57th anniversary of Sputnik, and that caused President Eisenhower to create an agency, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, known by its acronym ARPA, to make sure we didn't fall behind in science and technology. As ARPA funded a lot of computer research, eventually it decided in the late 60s that it should interconnect all these computers and started a project to do that. By September 1st, 1969, the first primitive router, called an Interface Message Processor, or IMP, was delivered to UCLA. And a month later, in October 1969, an IMP was delivered to the Stanford Research Institute. We scrambled trying to figure out how to make these things work, and by October 29th, 1969, we were ready to try something. So I tried to sit at a terminal at UCLA and log into the computer at Stanford Research Institute. So I was on a headset so I could actually talk to Bill Duvall, the person at Stanford Research Institute, and as I was typing, I would type an L. On that particular computer, you actually had to type the word login. It didn't ask you for your username or password. You had to type login. So I typed an L, and Bill said he got the L, and I saw that it printed on my terminal. I said, great, and I typed an O. He got the O. I typed a G, and he said, my system crashed. Let me call you back in half an hour. A half an hour later, we tried again, and this time it worked, and I was able to sit there using the computer at SRI in Menlo Park from my computer at UCLA in Los Angeles.
So that
was the beginning.
So the first characters ever typed were LOL.
Well, L-O.
Well, you put those three together, L-O-L.
Although the L-O is kind of cool, too. It's like, lo and behold, we're in a new age.
Right, that is. And so how many people were in the room? Were you the only one there?
I was the only one there that night. I was often working late at night. This was like 10:30 at night on a random night. I would often work till 3 or 4 in the morning. I was also one of those people who put together Heath kits.
Yeah, we all did. Did you realize at the time the significance of that event? Was there any way to know what it would blossom into?
I had no concept that this was going to be anything other than a way for us to share resources. And through the 70s, it was mostly a club of universities and some research places, and into the 80s before it began being used by a more general public. And it wasn't until the 90s, of course, that we really had the full Internet revolution.
This is Walter. It's good to talk to you again, Charlie. I saw him last week. You say you didn't know that this was the beginning of a revolution. Why don't you tell the listeners, because you just said something very nonchalant in your logbook. You just wrote down a little notation that's now part of history.
Yeah, we used to keep a logbook of, did the system crash? Did the IMP break? Did we have to load a different version of the software? And I just made a little log notation. Oh, I had successfully communicated host to host. The big computers were called hosts between UCLA and SRI. And that became the only documentation there is that this event ever occurred.
So where's the logbook now?
Len Kleinrock at UCLA has it. He asked me at one point if we had any documentation. I said, I think I made a note on a logbook, and he went scrambling around looking for those things from 30 years earlier and found it.
We take it for as a given, Charlie, that, and also, Walter, I ask you this, that the Internet is an open, distributed network. Could it have turned out differently? Walter, you want to start with?
Absolutely. I mean, what it is a packet switch network, which means that instead of having central hubs the way the phone system did, or dedicated circuits like the phone system, or even regional hubs the way an airline might have, every single node on the internet can store and forward and deal with information. This is important for many reasons. One is it could survive a nuclear attack, and even though the people building it didn't look upon that as the goal, some of the funders of the Pentagon did, but also it meant that nobody could censor it. It's like a spider's web, and these packets scurry around, and you take out one of the nodes, it just routes around it. And this has changed world history, because basically nobody controls the internet. Nobody takes out any of the hubs, and it's very hard to censor it.
Charlie, did people not want to have that freedom built into it?
We certainly wanted that freedom built into it. Some number of years later, there was some controversy at the Pentagon about how it was being used and what was being done on it. I remember in the 90s talking to the head of the FCC, and a congressman had asked him, why aren't we charging a penny for, or some getting a stamp for each email that's sent?
Years ago, I had a conversation with William Higginbotham, who was at Brookhaven in 1958 and had what could be argued as the first video game up under the oscilloscope he had as an exhibit. And this was almost 20 years ago when I talked to him. He's passed away. And I said to him, imagine if you could get a royalty for every video, if the government, which had the patent on it or had done it first, could have argued that they wanted a royalty for every video game ever made. There would go the deficit. He agreed. But he said that they weren't into that at that time. Speaking of the...
I need to make a comment that to agree with Walter that this was very much a collaborative development. There were researchers at all these different ARPA-funded sites that were working together to try to figure out how to make this thing work, what we could do with it. And there certainly was no single inventor or even a small number of people that were inventors.
Even the guy, Charlie, you know this, Steve Crocker, who is here and who lives in Washington, I've talked to him. He was in charge of taking notes, and he didn't want to make it seem like they were handing down instructions. So he titled all of the proposals they came up with Requests for Comment. So it would feel very collaborative as they built it.
Well, speaking of the internet, I want to play a clip. And this is from our own program. This is from Science Friday in 1993. We did a show called What is the Internet? And because there was no World Wide Web there, we actually had somebody try to describe what it would be like. And this is a clip from that show. All right, let's go to the internet and take our first call on the internet. Steve in Stockholm, Sweden. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi there. It's nice to be here, and meet here in Stockholm.
That's probably one of the longest links to get over to Sweden, and what we find is as we go through slower and slower lines to get across the ocean, it makes it harder to move the audio through.
So there's a lot of compression going on here? Or
There's compression and there's packet loss, because remember, this is not a dedicated line. This is part of the general purpose infrastructure, and so we're sending voice, but someone else may have started a big database search at the same time.
Oh, I see.
Might interfere.
Let me see if Steve, is Steve still there in Stockholm? Steve, we missed a little bit of what you were saying.
I sure am.
And that's what it was back in the early days of the internet. That was Carl Malamud on there with me and trying to give. You know, we had a caller at the end of the show. We said to people, what would you like to do with this thing called the internet? And right as we ran out of time, some guy said, wouldn't it be great someday if I could download my CD or I could buy music or something like that?
So you helped start Voice Over Internet and Napster all on that one show. You know, we make fun of Al Gore, but if I may, let me give him a little credit right at this point, because it's in 92, 93 when you do that the Gore Act kicks in and it allows you to do that show, because up until then, the internet was only for research institutions or, you know, universities. And the Gore Act not only expands it, but opens it up for a general public to be able to do things, which is a key part of the internet.
Yeah, and we were in New York, went out to California to Xerox PARC, got digitized and sent back out onto the internet, and mostly people in universities and educational places could hear it, but people had trouble. That's why I asked, did anybody really realize that the internet would be a commercial success that it is? Because I remember the first time, and maybe not, it maybe hasn't been a commercial success yet, but commercialized, I guess.
Correct.
Is what I'm saying. Because I remember the first browser that had commercials. What was it? I'm trying to remember the name.
Well, in 93, 94, the web comes along, and Mark Andreessen does Mosaic.
Which comes
out of the University of Illinois, where he's just a graduate student. And then I remember, because I was doing new media and digital media for Time Incorporated, we were on online services like AOL, CompuServe, right. And he came by our office and said, here, use this browser and go on the web. And we did, and we and the people at Wired Magazine and others sort of blazed the trail, for better or worse, which is, oh, we can use these browsers, and we could put banner ads on the top. So if we put up Time Inc. or Time Magazine, mm-hmm. we could put advertising. And in some ways, that led to an advertising-supported media on the Internet. We weren't really thinking too carefully. I think we thought people would pay to buy magazines on the Internet, but that was not the way it went.
Right. Are there collaborations? You talk about how the digital revolution is a bunch of people working mm-hmm. together. Do you see any collaborations now that are happening that are going to have a thesis of something new that we don't know about or we can't really see?
You know, when I asked Steve Jobs, what is the product you're most proud of creating? I thought he'd say the Mac or the iPhone or something. And he said, you know, creating a product is hard, but creating a team that can collaborate and make good products over and over again, that's the real goal. Mm-hmm. And I'm most proud of creating Apple. And so if you look at Apple and Google and other places now, most of them were sort of partnerships. Larry Page, Sergey Brin, they bring in Eric Schmidt to help manage it. Likewise, Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore, great visionaries, start Intel. They bring in Andy Grove to help manage it. You see how people who are visionaries and managers put together teams. I think you've got incredibly innovative teams working now. I mean, I'm so excited about all the things coming out these days.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, are you going to have any celebration this week, next week?
I'm not planning on anything special, but I'm sure there must be some somewhere.
We'll celebrate.
Charlie, thanks for joining us, and good luck to you, and happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Our number is 844-724-8255. Let's see if we have any calls. Let's see if let's get this one in. Let's go to Fred in Annapolis, Maryland. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, I have a question. I recall that Leonard Kleinlock had quite a bit to do with the invention of the digital transmitting communication with computers, but I didn't hear his name mentioned. What was his role in this?
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
Well, we did just mention him because when Charlie was talking about being down at UCLA doing it, he was working for Leonard Kleinrock. And it's Leonard Kleinrock's lab at UCLA that is the one connecting to SRI. Charlie was an employee of his, and that's now, as he said, he got the logbook, and you can go there and see one of the first sites on what was then called the ARPANET. Secondly, Leonard Kleinrock was instrumental in the 60s and 70s at understanding the mathematical underpinnings of packet switching. By that I mean if you break a message into small packets and you send it scurrying through the web like we talked about with a little address header on it, how much faster will messages travel, and how do you avoid log jams? Now, there's a lot of dispute, and I take it on in my book about, is that really inventing packet switching? Paul Barron actually is the one who, you know, invents packet switching. Donald Davies invents it in England and calls it packet switching. So there are a lot of people who flow into it, but you got to give Kleinrock credit for both helping build the original ARPANET and mm-hmm. having the mathematical underpinnings of packet switching.
We talked earlier about all of us being hobbyists and building old all kinds of machines when we were kids. Kids don't do that anymore. Have we lost something?
You know, in a larger sense, one reason I wrote this book is we feel a little bit more alienated from our technology now that we can't open up the back and see if the tube is burned out and all these things we did when we were very, very young. And I don't want people to feel alienated from technology because that makes it mm-hmm. so that you're back to being a Neanderthal, to get back to the beginning of this show. And so there's a guy named Lee Felsenthal who's a minor character in the book, but he's somebody who does the early community bulletin boards and personal computers. And he's trying to invent new toys now and ways that kids can do circuits the way we did when we used to solder them in our basement. Because I think, as Steve Wozniak always says, I learned to visualize how a circuit works, what an on-off switch does. And that's all every computer ever built ever since then really is, and I can picture it. And I fear sometimes we can produce kids who code, but not kids who visualize what the hardware does.
You hope that some of these maker fairs, we see all these kids
right, that would be
out.
Great if 3D printing and makers fairs could say, hey, let's, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of calls or letters, they're already doing it, but let's have maker fairs where people learn to build their own computers again.
Yeah, you know, there are these innovation centers and places where people are collaborating because they can't afford to build a lab of their own, but they go down in there and they build some stuff. I agree with you. I think the fact that you can't get hands-on and feel and touch.
You're not even
there's
allowed
no soul.
To take the battery out.
Yeah, there's no soul of a new machine here, right?
Exactly,
you can't
exactly.
feel the, you know, there's the zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance stuff to the machine.
And I think that a big history of Ludditism and technology for the past 400 years is if you know how it works. If you look at Ben Franklin, he basically could understand the Newtonian universe. You and I talked about this years ago. Einstein makes the universe slightly more intimidating. Suddenly time is relative and universe is curved and all those sort of things. And that makes us feel a little bit nervous and alienated and detached from our science. I try in this book, just as I did with Einstein and with Steve Jobs, to say, wait, these are real people. They're kind of cool people. They're kind of smarter than we are, but they're still human beings. And they understand how to bring these things forward. And I think if we understand the personal fingerprints that made these wonderful innovations, we'll feel that they're a little bit less intimidating and a little bit more things that can be part of our lives.
Walter, it's always good to have you here. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Dropping in. Walter Isaacson, author of The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. If you want to read an excerpt, we have an excerpt of it on our site. Go to sciencefriday.com/innovators.